At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
A factual data creation facility production.
From the foothills of Tennessee to your listening device of choice, it's the OFNT podcast. Now here's your host, who's still waiting for interesting tech news to materialize, Jim Schaefer.
Yeah, welcome to episode 279, which I'm calling the Motu Experiment. Yeah, I'm still struggling with my audio interface. Details in the podcasting section.
Great. We can hardly wait. Excitement is in the air. Not.
Yet again, not much is happening within the world of tech. Well, Google has an event slated for August, so there's that to look forward to. Be prepared for yet another short tech news section. Then, as usual. But it'll be a longer episode.
Yay!
Which will make some people happy.
Well, I'm pleased with that news.
Enough with this bantering with AI-generated voices. Let's just get this show in motion.
Well, before I do that, I have a correction. In the podcast section of the last episode, I had a story about the British Broadcasting Corporation, the good old BBC. I had stated that I started noticing a political slant in reporting from the BBC around the time of the First Gulf War. What I meant to say was around the time of the start of the Iraqi War. Same goes with the BBC newsreader pronouncing President Bush's name as Bush.
So that would mean that my comment about recalling that presenter's pronunciation at that time could also be considered gulp wrong?
Well, yes, I'd say so.
The blame for this error lies squarely on you, the host. With the accent that I possess, and weld so eloquently, I can't be held at fault.
Whatever helps you sleep at night, or whatever it is that you do. Tech news. Boy, those guys from Cupertino love to sit around and think of more ways to squeeze money from their customers.
Yes.
TheVerge.com is reporting that Apple has launched a subscription service called Care One.
Not to be confused with Apple Care.
Care One will cost one $20 per month. The service will cover up to 3 Apple products with the option of tacking on more devices at a cost of $5.95 each. This coverage includes all of the things that Apple Care Plus does, like batteries and limited repairs for accidental damage and 24-hour support. You can also add products that are up to 4 years old to your Care One subscriptions, with the caveat that these products are in good condition. Apple will know how good of a condition these products are in because they'll run diagnostic checks on them before allowing you to add them to your plan. Theft and loss coverage is included for the iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch. Just what the world needs. Another monthly subscription service.
Ouch!
No!
I can see this appealing to people who spend most of their time out and about using their Apple gear constantly, but for most people, especially old farts like myself, this service isn't a great deal.
Well, if you're worried about breaking any of your devices and not being able to afford the out-of-pocket cost for repair, this service may appeal to you.
Maybe. I've never gotten Apple Care on any of my devices. Only once did I have an iPhone display crack on me. It was an iPhone 5, and I was prepared to shell out the money for repair at Apple. The display had a small crack at the very top left of the screen. While at the Apple store, the technician examined the phone and came to the conclusion that the damage was not caused by me and replaced the screen gratis. I appreciated this, and the incident made me stick with Apple. 9to5Mac.com, and of course every Apple-centric tech site, is heralding the release of the public beta for iOS 26, iPadOS 26, and macOS 26, and all the rest of Apple's operating systems. This is the version that features the new Liquid Glass user's interface.
It's gorgeous.
So we've all been told. This beta brings Mac-like features to the iPad and iPad-like features to the Mac. Normally I'd be all over this public beta, but times have changed. These days I prefer stability over new features. Well, so far. The only feature I'm really looking forward to is from macOS 26. Apple is adding the phone app to Macs, and this will be good for loopback recordings. And that's something only podcasters and audio geeks will fully appreciate. I'll be holding off from this beta until late August, if I decide to participate at all. Have you tried this new public beta yet? If so, let me know what you think of it. If you're of a certain age, then you'd remember when the BlackBerry phone ruled the mobile communication world. Perhaps BlackBerry can be credited with revolutionizing it. I know up in New York at the time of BlackBerry's dominance, more people were using it than the upstart iPhone. The BlackBerry was popular because of mainly two things: a great hardware QWERTY keyboard and BlackBerry Messenger. It was as if you were in an exclusive club when you used a BlackBerry phone, because that was the only way you could use BlackBerry Messenger. Well, for a brief time, you could get BlackBerry Messenger on certain Nokia E-series phones, but that didn't last very long. I bought a cheap BlackBerry for use at work because most of my coworkers used one and used BBM for communication. This was after BlackBerry stopped charging extra to use the company's servers. Apple took a cue from BlackBerry and introduced their version of BBM, which was, of course, iMessage, with the release of the iPhone 4S. That's the phone that lured me into the famed walled garden, which I still reside in to this day.
Yes.
After the introduction of iMessage, it was only a matter of time for Apple to dominate, challenged only by Android. To be honest, besides BBM, I didn't use my BlackBerry for much else. The only other thing that I liked about BlackBerry was the darn phone would be able to have a usable cellular signal just about anywhere, even in places where other phones were relegated to being nothing but paperweights. Eventually, my coworker switched to iPhones with a sprinkling of Android phones.
Well, that's a great story. Thanks for sharing it. But I have to ask, is there a point to it?
Well, yes, there is, and I'm getting to it. According to an article from AndroidPolice.com, well, there's a plan to bring the BlackBerry phone back from the dead.
What?
Back during, and I guess after BlackBerry's heyday, a website dedicated to it called CrackBerry was the number one website for all things BlackBerry related. The site was held by Kevin Michaluk, better known as CrackBerry Kevin, who never gave up on BlackBerry and has been advocating for its return ever since. He's worked for manufacturer TCL, who've released Android-based BlackBerry clones while licensing the BlackBerry name. Mr. Michaluk was also responsible for the Click Case. That was a physical keyboard case for iPhones and select Android phones. Recently, CrackBerry Kevin has started a petition for the return of BlackBerry phones. His justifications are a current nostalgia for phones with mechanical keyboards. I don't know about that. A desire to spend less time on a phone, while also being less distracted by it. Good motives indeed, but I have some questions. What form factor will this new BlackBerry take? What mobile operating system will it run? An updated BlackBerry OS? Or a skinned Android copy of it? While nostalgia is a factor here, nostalgia also fades after a while. Plus, I'm very comfortable with the interoperability between my iPhone, iPad, Mac, and Apple TV box. BlackBerry never had a hardware ecosystem like that. The younger generations who preferred the large screen slabs we have today either barely remember BlackBerry or have absolutely no memory of the phone, or the company. I'm of the opinion that this resurrection of the BlackBerry won't get off the ground. Mr. Mitchlock seems to be attempting to recapture his youth. Unfortunately for him, it's time to let the past go. The world has moved on, and I think he should too. I'll finish this short tech news section with a modern communication method, that being rich communication service, known as RCS, and its constant improvements. The GSMA, who oversee RCS standards, has just released Universal Profile 3.1. This new standard improves connectivity, onboarding, and notifications. This is accomplished by streamlining the way RCS clients connect to operator services and tighter integration within operating systems' push notification services. Audio codecs have also been upgraded. All these improvements are to RCS's back end, but will contribute greatly to its performance. I add in the recent approval of a standard for end-to-end encryption, and we finally have a contender for a secure, true universal messaging system. The problem for RCS, though, is twofold. Carriers and phone manufacturers have to adopt these standards, and so do consumers. Apple was basically forced to adopt RCS, and many smaller manufacturers are yet to come on board. Google has been the leading proponent of RCS, and their version of it is completely different than the official standards, meaning that not all phones will be completely compatible. Not all cellular service carriers have implemented RCS yet either. Mainly the small ones haven't done so yet. When Apple first implemented RCS, I went through my contact list to see how many of my Android-using friends had activated RCS on their phones. The answer? One of about 12 of them had. Just before recording this episode, I checked again. About half of them had activated RCS, and that was most likely upon buying a new phone. So until these hurdles are cleared, RCS will remain in the background for most consumers. It'll be up to the carriers, manufacturers, and the GSMA itself to get the word out about RCS. And that's my opinion anyway. Tech I'm Using. Like the tech industry, my tech I'm using situation seems to be on a summer hiatus. All of the tech I have on hand is functioning properly and, more importantly, reliably.
You can't ask more from tech than that.
That's a fact. I still haven't gotten around with playing with Alexa Plus. I would like to put the digital assistant's conversationality, if that's even a word, to the test. There's still something off-putting about conversing with a non-living entity for me, though. My cheap, in comparison to other models, ONN television soundbar is performing well, and I'm enjoying it. When I upgrade my current television, then I'll consider upgrading soundbars. Speaking of which, I never received a return shipping label for my broken LG soundbar. Now, this marks the second time I've had a problem with LG. The first being the television taking over 30 days to ship from a mere 60 miles away. When I do upgrade my television, I'm considering a Vizio OLED along with one of the company's higher-end soundbars. As far as future tech, the only things on the horizon for me is a new iPhone, and no, I still haven't decided which model I want to get yet, and maybe a pair of upcoming AirPods Pro. My lovely wife still uses the first version of them, so she'll be inheriting my current second-generation AirPod Pros. Other than those two things, there's nothing tech-related I'm really looking forward to. Oh, wait. Where's my Tesla self-driving car that was promised for this year?
I don't know.
Entertainment news. Last week I mentioned watching the first episode of the new Prime Video series, Ballard. The show's a spin-off of the very successful series Bosch. It stars Maggie Q, who you might remember from the Nikita series from years ago. I had only watched the first episode of Ballard, which was basically a setup episode, and reserved judgment of the series until I had at least a couple of episodes more under my belt. Well, I managed to make it to episode 4, despite passive interference from the one whom must be obeyed, who doesn't care for police-based shows. Well, I can say that I enjoy Ballard, though it doesn't bring anything new to the old police procedural genre. Unlike Bosch, Ballard does introduce some subtle virtue signaling into the episodes, but does attempt to make this virtue signaling gentle, part of the plot in most cases. In other words, viewers are not hit over the head with the so-called message.
Well, thank goodness for that.
It was fun seeing some of the characters from the Bosch series make appearances in Ballard. Maggie Q is in fine form, both physically and in acting skill, and carries the show well. So if you're in a mood for a decent, mostly non-offensive police procedure type television show, well, Ballard is a safe pick. Last week, I, like everyone else, received news of the passing of Ozzy Osbourne, lead singer of the band that is credited for inventing heavy metal music, the legendary Black Sabbath. I knew Ozzy wasn't in the best of health, but this news still shocked me. A little over 2 weeks before his passing, he reunited with the band for one last performance. Perhaps he knew his time was almost up. At least he got his wish of performing one last time with his band. I had always assumed that Bill Ward, the drummer of Black Sabbath, would be the first to go. Old Bill has been in ill health for many years now. The news of Ozzy's death hit me hard, as Black Sabbath was my, or is my, all-time favorite band. I was into Black Sabbath before it was considered cool to be into Black Sabbath. When I was a young teenager, Led Zeppelin and Deep Purple ruled the hard rock scene. But most of my fellow teenagers, at least the ones that I knew, were into country rock, you know, like the Doobie Brothers and the Outlaws. I despised this music genre, so needless to say, I was an outsider when it came to musical taste. The problem for Black Sabbath was that the band received absolutely no radio play. You couldn't even find Black Sabbath records in stores. With no such thing as the internet yet, the only way I knew of Black Sabbath was from magazines that covered the hard rock music scene. These magazines would often describe Sabbath as demonic and devil-worshipping, which somehow appealed to the young me, probably because it was different. Black Sabbath had a sort of mystique for me. Of course, the band was neither demonic nor were they devil-worshipping. First time I ever heard the band came when I was staying over at my friend Tom's house one Saturday. His house had a finished basement, complete with cool lighting, a bar, a television, and a pretty good stereo for the time. Tom's older sister had a large collection of music on the 8-track format.
What is this 8-track that you speak of?
I recommend you go to your favorite search engine if you want to find out what an 8-track cassette was. Anyhow, Tom had fallen asleep, and me being a night owl, searched through a box of these 8-track tapes that was just laying around. Finding a bright-colored one, sporting the now-famous cover for the Paranoid album, I was finally going to hear Black Sabbath instead of just hearing about them. I put on some headphones and slid the 8-track tape into the socket on the stereo player, pushed the play button, and turned up the volume. The first song that played was Fairies Wear Boots. Well, I had never heard anything like it before, especially the bass playing. I listened to the entire Paranoid album more than a few times that evening. The first Black Sabbath album I purchased for myself was Technical Ecstasy. On the day I enlisted in the military, I went and saw Black Sabbath in concert for the first time at Madison Square Garden. That was in December of 1976. I had nosebleed seats, but I was excited to be there. Ted Nugent was the opening act, and I couldn't wait for him to be finished. Eventually, he did finish, and I waited for Black Sabbath. And I waited, and I waited, and I waited. The crowd was becoming restless, and no other than Frank Zappa came out to calm the crowd down. I remember the guy sitting next to me exclaiming, "What is he doing here?" upon seeing Zappa. Many years later, I learned that Zappa was supposed to play a couple of songs with Sabbath. It never happened because Tony Iommi's guitar had to be restrung, hence the delay, and time just ran out. Black Sabbath finally took the stage, and while I enjoyed the set, well, you could tell something was off, and it wasn't the band's best performance. A few years later, I got to see Sabbath again, this time at the Oxford New Theatre in the UK. A new band from California called Van Halen opened for Sabbath, and my friend Rick was pretty impressed with them. Me? Not so much. I never became a fan of Van Halen. Black Sabbath's performance was much better than the one I saw at Madison Square Garden. And yes, they played Fairies Wear Boots and most of my favorite songs during that show. The band was kicking off their Never Say Die tour, but the only song from the album that they played was Junior's Eyes. I remember Rick turning to me after the final encore and saying, "You know, Ozzy Osbourne has the weirdest singing voice I've ever heard," before turning his head back towards the stage, where the band was lined up taking a bow. Bill Ward suddenly started vomiting, and the other members quickly disengaged and left the stage, leaving Bill, now collapsed, all alone on that stage. A year or so later, upon my return to the States, I was visiting my family, and when going to the local shopping center, a place I'd hung around during my misplaced youth, I eyed a store's outside back wall covered with graffiti that read Black Sabbath in very large lettering, which took up most of the store's wall. My contemporaries had finally caught up to me. Of course, Ozzy went on to have a solo career, which I wasn't a huge fan of, and then the Osbourne's reality show hit big. Now, I still followed Black Sabbath, but the band just wasn't the same without Ozzy. When Ozzy rejoined the band for the 13 album and tour, I tried to purchase tickets for the concert, but they were sold out. Ticket scalpers wanted over $500 for limited view seats, and I just couldn't justify that. I did watch Sabbath's final set from the Back to the Beginning show a few weeks ago, but unlike many, I felt that both Ozzy's and drummer Bill Ward's performances were just not up to par. My son agreed, but gave them props for daring to perform at their advanced age. Though my good friend Rick thought Ozzy's voice was weird, I always thought it was unique. A unique, one-of-a-kind voice that we will never hear live again. So rest in peace, Ozzy. The world will definitely miss you. I know I will.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Podcast news. As the title of this episode inferred, I experimented with my old Motu M2 interface last week. That audio interface was given to me as a Christmas present some years ago by my son and replaced a Scarlett 2i2 interface I'd been using since the first episode of this podcast. The Motu was quite a leap over the Scarlett product I was using. Back then, I had the Motu running through a DBX 286S analog channel strip, which gave me a noise gate and other features I had lacked in my previous setup, along with some much-needed preamp gain for my microphones. Heck, I even dusted off that Motu setup and used it for the recording of the From the Kitchen episode last June down here in Tennessee.
If I'm not mistaken, the From the Kitchen episode was the first to be recorded from the new place.
You took your time saying that, but you're correct. I hadn't yet taken delivery of my computer desk or, in fact, any other furniture yet, and set up my gear on the kitchen island counter and recorded while seated in a lawn chair.
Wow.
It was very uncomfortable, to say the least, and I had incorrectly set the de-esser so I sounded like I had a lips on the recording. My more modern setup was still in New York, being that I was still spending more time up there at that point. Anyway, last week I set the Motu up, sans DBX channel strip, to test out the use of a software noise gate, all in an effort to see if I could use a modern audio interface which didn't include any digital signal processing.
Now, what was the purpose of this experiment, if I might ask?
Well, if successful, I could save myself some money on the purchase of a new audio interface which doesn't have DSP included.
Skinflint.
The first thing I noticed using the Motu without the DBX unit was that the preamps of the device couldn't properly drive my ElectroVoice RE20 microphone.
Oh no, why?
This was the problem of the not-so-long-ago era of consumer audio interfaces, like the Moto M2 when it was released. The Moto and its contemporaries were woefully underpowered when it came to their preamps. The second thing I noticed was that the headphone amp couldn't properly drive my headphones to a usable volume without introducing distortion. Yet another problem of consumer audio interfaces of that time period. Back then, in order to drive a microphone like the RE20 and especially the Shure SM7B, you either had to have a channel strip like the DBX or a signal booster like a Fethead or Cloudlifter in order to use mics such as these. Also, though the Motu has two microphone inputs, only one head jack was supplied with that unit. Another characteristic of consumer audio interfaces of that time. Up in New York, I really needed to have a noise gate in order to filter out aircraft, passing semi-trucks and trains, loud neighbors, and other sounds of the noisy area I resided in at the time. Here in Tennessee, the central air unit and the next-door neighbor's dog are the chief concerns as far as noise goes. I downloaded a free and simple noise gate from Nebrini for this experiment.
Cheapskate.
Using the plugin's presets, I found that the gate was either too strong, which cut off some of the words I spoke, or too weak, which let in noise, mainly from the central air unit, into my recordings. Even while attempting to manually dial in the noise gate's settings, I got the same results. I even tried using various noise reduction plugins in tandem with the noise gate plugin, but this just added digital artifacts to my recordings. The Lewitt Connect 6 interface I use now is perfect, except for the USB input for a mobile device, which, no matter what I've tried, refuses to work properly. I tried using Loopback, which should allow you to record sounds from your computer, but while this works for pre-recorded media, for some reason, the levels are too low when recording live phone calls to be usable. The way I was using Loopback was to send the phone call's audio to my computer via Apple's AirDrop.
So, I guess you can call your experiment a failure then.
Yes, overall it was a failure. I do have hope, though. The Connect 6 also features a 3.5mm input connector, so I ordered a 3.5mm TRS to USB-C cable from Amazon, which will be here on Monday. If that doesn't work, Mac OS 26 adds the phone app to the operating system, so you can make and receive calls from your computer via Wi-Fi. This may alleviate the problem I'm having with Loopback, because I won't have to use AirPlay in order to get the phone's audio onto my computer. The current edition of Mac OS does have a FaceTime app. Perhaps I'll give that a shot and see what happens. I also thought about just buying another Connect 6. The one I currently use was an open box return. That may have been the reason for that return. The USB-C input connector just wasn't working. While recently reading reviews of the Connect 6 on Amazon, I found that the leading complaint about it was that the USB-C cell phone input was not working. To be fair, those reviews weren't in English, and only when I translated them did I see those complaints. When I bought the Connect 6, these reviews had yet to be posted. If all this fails, it looks like I'll have to purchase a Rodecaster Duo. It's the only audio interface on the market that has all the features I need. All of the other affordable audio interfaces I've been looking at either don't have DSP or an input for a mobile device. If and when I'm able to connect a phone to my interface, I can start having guests on the show. And who knows, perhaps a co-host.
Hang on, you already have a bevy of co-hosts. Some even have the same glorious accent as I.
No offense, but I'm talking a real-life co-host here.
Oh, I see.
Time magazine, which used to be a thing back in what many believe to be the day, released a list called the 100 Best Podcasts of All Time.
Okay.
Noticeably absent from this list was the Joe Rogan Experience, Pod Save America, the No Agenda podcast, and others. Instead, podcasts like Call Her Daddy, Making Oprah, and many other unknown podcasts made the list. Of course, the usual favorites of a certain political bent were present. And that's why I don't understand why Pod Save America didn't make the list. I guess that show wasn't far enough to the left for the author to include in that show. Also missing, as far as I could tell, was any independent podcast, but, you know, that's to be expected these days. I do understand that not every podcast can make the list, but Call Her Daddy? Give me a break. As you probably know, I'm a big fan of audio dramas, especially those dealing with the paranormal or a dystopian future. My current favorites are The Roads to Shadows, Haunted, the audio drama, and The Strata. You know, out of curiosity, I decided to peruse the show notes of the latest episode of Road to Shadows, which included links to the voice actors' websites. Most websites listed the equipment these actors used. I was expecting to see mostly UA Apollo audio interfaces paired with Neumann TLM-103s being used in the majority by them. But instead, I found many to be using inexpensive gear like the Rode NT1 mics and SSL consumer interfaces. Heck, even the Moto M2, which I own and just talked about, was listed by a couple of them. One piece of equipment that's common with all these voice actors is a dedicated recording booth, most professionally built with a few homemade ones listed. This is something I wish I had, but I can't afford a professionally installed one and haven't had time to look into what goes into making a homemade version. Then again, for what I produce, it probably wouldn't be worth my time or effort, but it would be nice. Perhaps one day I will build a recording booth for myself.
Keep dreaming, sport. Keep dreaming.
I will. The music is playing and this episode is almost done and dusted. Hope you enjoyed this episode. I enjoyed making it for you. If you like what you heard, you can make a donation using the link in the show notes. Any and all donations will be greatly appreciated. You can always reach me at ofntpodcast@gmail.com, and that's only if you're so inclined. I'd enjoy hearing from you. Remember, don't listen to what they say. Watch what they do. Well, our fence is going up on Wednesday, so enjoy milling about here while you can. But in the meantime, get off my lawn. Stay skeptical. I'm out.
See ya.
And that, folks, is the end of the show.